Hello and welcome to another episode of Final Cut Grill. Hey, my name is Chris Fenwick and this is episode 041. And this evening we're going to talk with Darren Rourke. Now, Darren is a guy I met at NAB this year. And he was working for FCP Works. And he was demoing in their demo suite. He also got tapped to do a bunch of demos in the Red booth. So if you went by the Red booth and saw some guy over there with a crowd of people around him showing off Final Cut 10 and how you could ingest media, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, that would have been Darren. So I contacted him. I said, hey, come be on the show. And he was like all into that. So that's that. Before we get going, I want to mention and I want to thank from the bottom of my heart the people at Premium Beats, premiumbeat.com, for sponsoring the show and supporting what we're doing here because they believe in Final Cut 10. So much so that they have asked me to do a series of tutorials. Now, I've submitted the first one. I don't know what the process is going to be, you know, if they're going to post that right away, but there's a couple of tutorials coming about the best way to integrate your temp files into your full productions. And it's some pretty cool tricks, and there's some things that I've been doing for years and years. And I wanted to share that with you, and Premium Beats is going to put that on their website. So when I know for certain that it's there, I'll probably tweet it over the show Twitter account. And I think you're going to dig that stuff. So if you've ever been in a situation where you're like, you're done with your edit and you go, oh, wait, the watermark is still there. You know, that guy in the background going premiumbeats.com. This is the bomber trick about how to swap that music out literally in seconds, regardless of any fades you've done, regardless of any EQ adjustments you've done, regardless of any editing and stretching and shortening of the cut to make it fit your piece better, you're going to dig this trick. So it's a couple of tutorials, and I love Premium Beats. Enough of that. Let's move forward, and we will go to our interview with Darren Rourke from FCP Works. How you been? It was fun seeing you at the NAB.
Yeah, it was. Nice to have met you in person. Heard a lot about you, heard the podcast a bunch of times. It's kind of a nice little oasis of sanity.
The oasis of sanity. Hold on, I got to write that down. That might be the name of the episode, right in the first sentence.
But you don't have to write it down because it's recorded. So.
Yeah, but I'll oasis of sanity. I like that. Okay, so How did we meet? I think I met you for the first time at the FCP Works suite, the demo suite. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. They were. We were still getting set up, and you dropped by. That was.
I crashed the party. I had contacted Michael Garber, and I said, "Are you sure I can't come at 10?" He's like, "Okay, fine, come at 10." So, yeah, I think you guys were still wiring things when I walked in.
Yeah, it's. You know, it's quite a big, you know, undertaking to have to put together that much, you know, computer hardware.
And, oh, yeah.
I mean, it was just, yeah, it's a little, you know, and you're in Vegas at the same time.
Right.
So there's that.
Okay, well, we'll get to that. And I want to talk about all the stuff that you were setting up there and the things that you guys were demoing. But first, I think it's more important that people understand just your background in this business. How did you get started in this business?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. You know, I just had always been making little dumb short films with my friends when I was a kid. And when I realized you could actually do that for a living, I was like, okay, sign me up for that. So I got one of my first jobs I worked at in the 90s, it was really like a sound mixing house, but the guy I worked for did everything. He had every piece of equipment, and I was in film school at the time, and that, you know, visiting his shop was part of the, you know, it was like a field trip, I guess. And when I met him, and he was super arrogant but super intelligent, and I said, I want to work for this guy. So I did, and he was kind of like grad school.
Wow. But, okay. Yeah. And so in the grand scheme of things, was he a filmmaker or was it video production? How would you classify that experience for you?
He was, well, you know, it's funny because, you know, I had this, it's a very Midwestern way of looking at things, which is, you know, if you want to be a filmmaker, you better learn at least enough about everybody's job so you, you know, can actually communicate things. Right. But since I, you know, after living in New York for a few years and now here, it's, boy, how wrong was I, but...
Are you saying that you were wrong in terms of the need to understand everybody's job?
Well, I don't think I was – I wasn't wrong for my own – you know, for what I wanted out of that situation. It's just more – I think it's almost like the less you know, the higher up you can get in some ways. But oh, that's interesting. That's a whole different topic. No, but he was more of like – the, you know, the post-production, you know, man on the mountain that you, you know, went to when you have problems.
Right. And
he was, you know, he was amazing.
So the guy that you were working for, what was his name?
Dennis O'Rourke. He passed away about 7 years ago, okay. Sadly. But
And you lived where in the Midwest?
Minneapolis.
Okay.
It's, yeah, no, like around the 90s is when, you know, they had a lot of feature films being made in Minnesota because they had one of the first, you know, state rebates for production. And so,
yes.
So that really kind of, you know, that really kind of jump started me realizing that you could actually make a living at this. So,
yeah, that's a really controversial topic. And it has been a big deal, like in the VFX community. We've been trying to do. We have a whole show we're going to do about that on Digital Cinema Cafe, and we've been trying to line up the guest for that. But that's a whole nother topic. This was in the
90s though, when you know, was it the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Nobody really foresaw the. You know, the future impact on how this would actually affect anything. And
yeah,
they've since stopped it in Minnesota. And so now films that were written and set there now are shot in Detroit or wherever else looks enough. Like even the Fargo TV show is now being shot in Canada.
Really? Interesting. Really, yeah. And, you know, and if people don't know about this, I would really recommend you delve a little into the whole idea of tax credits and subsidies and what it means, you know, if you're in that community, it might be good for you. But it can also be really bad. So it's not a slam dunk either way, I don't think. But again, like I said, it's a topic that we're going to do on an upcoming episode of Digital Cinema Cafe. And It's a huge issue. So at any rate, we won't get into the really politics is. Of all of that. So then how did you get from Minneapolis out to Hollywood?
Well, gosh, see.
Darren, the answer kind of is by car, plane, or bus. No, I'm kidding.
Well, that, you know, that's actually a harder question because I kind of went to New York.
Oh, okay.
The mid-aughts or whatever you call them.
What were you doing in New York?
Pretty much what I'm doing now, which is, you know, freelance editing. And, you know, I had an HVX 200 at the time and did a lot of shoots with that. And so just, you know, kind of a one-man band type person.
Uh-huh.
And then the Writers Guild strike happened and a lot of my, you know, work went away. So I said, well... it's probably going to be easier to fight up for work when you don't have to worry about paying your heating bill. So I came to L.A.
So
in about 2008.
Okay, so that's really interesting. I would think that would be the time to be getting out of Hollywood. What was your logic there?
Boy, when you put it, like, what was my logic?
I don't mean to ruin everything for you, but it's, I remember when that happened and there was a whole lot of picketing and a lot of, You know, it's really interesting, I think, that when, you know, Hollywood people start picketing and complaining about their life, you know, from the outside, everybody goes, ah, shut up. You make movies and TV shows. How hard could your life be? Of course, when you look at it from the inside, it is very difficult. But you chose to move to L.A. right, you know, as the strike was getting, you know, was a big deal.
Well, if you're gonna shake the tree, you might as well get as close to the roots as possible.
I got you.
So, because you know, here, all the managers, everybody live here. They have offices in New York, but that's not where they make everything happen.
Interesting. And, okay.
Because New York, I mean, I realized, you know, I started working suddenly with people that worked on Saturday Night Live. That were just desperate to try to get work during the strike. And right. I'm like, well, it's probably going to be easier to make less money in Los Angeles. And I was right about that. So,
yeah, I mean, I've said to people all the time, especially young kids getting into the business and trying to find their footing, that what we do is we climb ladders. And this is true for our business as well as any others. And, you know, if you look at two A-frame ladders that are touching each other at the feet, they fan out away from each other as you climb those ladders. And when you're standing at the bottom between the ladders, it's inconsequential which ladder you choose to start climbing. As you climb up those ladders, you get 3, 4, 5 rungs up. It's really difficult to step across. You might actually have to go backwards, cross over, and then go back up. So I tell people all the time, you should really try and figure out what it is you want to do and start climbing that ladder. You know, I mean, if you want to make feature films, you might want to go to LA. If you want to do soap operas, you might want to go to New York. If you want to work on Broadway, you got to be in New York. But find the ladder that you want to climb and start climbing, you know, be patient one step at a time, but it's really hard to change ladders midstream.
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, what's interesting is a lot of people I knew in New York now live here, and, you know, that just kind of, you know, it is really kind of surprising because I was one of the first of the people that I work with and friends with, and now most of them live here. So guess I made the right call.
Yeah. So what type of work, and I'm talking about your editorial work and whatnot, what type of work are you doing these days?
Well, it kind of is divided into, you know, my personal work, which, you know, I direct short films and done a lot of music videos. Over the years.
Okay.
And as far as editing, I've kind of been evolving into being more of like what my former boss was, which was the guy who would fix everything. When people would start off, you know, with, like I said, you know, that phrase again, the best of intentions, and not, you know, think that they can do it. And then when they can't, then they call somebody like me.
Right.
So that's kind of, because, you know, it's a lot easier for me to work in that capacity with people than editing somebody else's footage. Like, I've finally came to that realization about myself.
Explain what you're saying there.
Well, I mean, I guess this segues nicely into, you know, the other topic, which is Final Cut 10. But a lot of, like, I'm working on about 3 documentaries right now.
Okay.
And other than giving, you know, overall story suggestions, I really have nothing creative to do with them. I'm just keeping them on track.
Right.
And, you know, helping them avoid making costly mistakes. And it's kind of nice because I'm not using my creative energy on other people's hopes and dreams anymore, but yet I'm still serving a, you know, useful purpose.
Right. I see what you're saying. So you're offering, you know, technical advice and counseling and direction, but you're not necessarily emotionally attached to the story.
Right. Because, you know, it's interesting that when I made that decision to specialize in, you know, I'm kind of, in a way, I'm like a hands-off post-production supervisor. Like, I come in when I'm needed, I check in on things, and if I have to, you know, if I have to do anything or actually fix anything, then that's how I know I failed at that point. But I still, you know, can usually most often, you know, fix things. It's just works out a lot better for people because, you know, people are, you know, it's starting to get to a point now where people don't want to have somebody that's just over, you know, staring at a screen and they have to sit in the couch and tell them what to do.
Right.
Like, it's going away from that. And there are also people that just can't, you know, would never know how to be an editor, and they, you know, they need to work with editors. But right. I'm more about the people that they at least want to get the film, say, 80% of the way there, and then bring in an editor afterwards.
Yeah,
and that works really well in documentaries.
Yeah, it's really hard for, you know, I know myself, and I don't do documentaries, I don't do features, I don't do television programming. I just find it really difficult when I have to get thrust into somebody else's messy hard drive and start making heads or tails of it. It's just such a nightmare for me.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a lot of respect for people that do that all the time. You know, they deserve, you know, huge kudos for being able to deal with it and do that.
Yeah, there have been things I've seen recently that I never knew anybody would ever even think to do that. You know, I have a film where the guy got really frustrated with how many layers he had, and so he just rendered it out and brought it back in and got rid of all his work and started cutting over it.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah. I'm like, I don't know.
And he lost all his time code.
Oh yeah. No trail of breadcrumbs. So I was like,
Oh, I love that phrase. Trail of breadcrumbs. You know what? That's a really powerful thing. I talk about that. I've never used that phrase, but any file in a timeline, there should be a way to trace it back to the application that created it, you know, and you should be able to follow all of those steps.
Yeah, this was a self-contained QuickTime movie with nothing. So, wow. And a lot of them too. So I'm still putting that one back together.
Crazy. Okay, so now from an edit hardware standpoint, what systems have you worked on in your career?
Well, gosh, my first nonlinear editor was a Marconi 8-plate. So
that's
there's that.
That's a film bed editor thing.
Yeah, deal. Yeah.
Okay.
Way back.
So you've cut on Avid.
I have. I haven't touched Avid pretty much in, I don't know, 10 years.
Okay.
As far as using it for anything I've made.
Gotcha. So, and then after that, you did, and again, the whole point of this is I'm trying to figure out where you came from. Were you a Final Cut Classic editor? Did you?
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's where I mean, what's funny is I was, I worked at a post house in, would have been 99 to 2000, after I left the first place I mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And I bought the blue and white J3 and Final Cut and brought it in. I was like an assistant editor / telecine assistant. So I was kind of a floater because I had experience in both. And the guys that, you know, were Avid cutters, I brought in the computer and showed them Final Cut, and they're just like, "This is the most ridiculous thing. Why did you spend that much money on this? You know, this is like a joke." Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that, and then they were like, "Yeah, we obviously pay you too much too." So it didn't go so well. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, we pay you enough that you can buy your own edit system. Maybe we need to rethink that.
Yeah, but it was only $4,000 at the time. That was, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty unbelievable. But yeah, I kind of never looked back once I started using that.
Okay, so let's get into Final Cut 10 then. When did you first start looking at it / using it?
First day it came out, I mean, I guess there was that that little like bootleg YouTube video that got leaked,
right?
Where they introduced it, and I was like, that looks pretty cool. And I hated it at first. I just couldn't understand, and you know, I ruined projects because I didn't read the manual, which, you know, that's my fault. But yeah, I moved folders, you know, out of places I shouldn't have, and I mean, it was just, yeah, horrible. So I put it down for a few months, and then I was doing something for Funny or Die, and I decided to give it another shot because of the chroma keyer working so quickly.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And by then they had, you know, there's like, I think, 2 updates by that point. And boy, it was, you know, a lot to get my head around, but after I did, you know, it really snapped into place, and I kind of haven't wanted to use anything else since.
I actually have, one of the listeners has sent me a chart with the dates and the release numbers and the features of all of the various releases, I guess I'm trying to say. And let me think. 2 updates would be 10.02, fixes issues in which the title may revert, resolving issue, third-party mobile devices, playback incorrectly, addresses stability issues caused by changing the start time on a compound clip. Anyway, yeah, I think I have gotten to the point where I am really in love with the chroma keyer myself now.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. I mean, to literally not have to even do anything, you just drag it on. I mean, for the first time, I was able to chroma key as fast as I could edit. Like, I didn't even have to think about it anymore.
It's really crazy. Yeah, I mean, if you have a good plate that somebody has shot with a nice background, it's astonishing how well it works. I'm totally amazed by it. And you know, if I look at the way I used to edit green screen shoots, you know, a bunch of talking heads, it was, you know, cut it in 7 and export the timeline and go into the After Effects and Keynote or Keylight, whatever.
Just yeah, that was the only thing that could really chroma key DV footage.
Oh yeah, actually, you know what? I totally avoided DV. I think for the era of DV, that 5 or 6 years, whatever, I literally just told my clients I don't chroma key.
You missed all the fun then.
No, I did not.
You know, when you swing 2 bats to make it harder on yourself, and then when you actually get up to the plate.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. Whereas if you can chroma key DV footage, you can do anything.
That's true. But I just was, you know, I had done plenty of green screen work with, you know, the Media 100, and I was never happy with it. And I was just like, ugh, I don't want to do this. I understand why we're shooting on DV, but yeah, I avoided it like the plague for a long, long time.
The keychain format—that was what its nickname was back then.
The keychain format. I don't know. I've never heard that term.
Because of the size of the tape, but I don't think anybody realized how small an SD card was going to be. So.
I know.
Perspective.
That was my biggest beef when we went from, you know, Beta SP to DV, is like the label was too small to actually write anything on it, you know. And yeah, and now we're dealing with SD cards, which are just a joke. Yeah,
I know, it's like Tic Tacs that have footage on them.
Very, very valuable Tic Tacs.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
especially the little mini ones that go in the audio recorders. Okay, so let's get this back on track. So you did the Funny or Die pieces. You mentioned the chroma keyer was very powerful, and it editing green screen at the same speed of just cutting normal footage. What were those things where it just like blew your mind and you're like, ugh, why isn't everybody using this?
You know, it's funny. I didn't have that feeling until I had to go back to Final Cut 7 and work on something. I had to work on, I actually took a freelance editing gig on a big kind of like infotainment documentary thing. And boy, did I really feel it then. It hadn't really occurred to me. It was just like, this is my preference. I kind of like this better now. Yeah, there were still a couple things that you couldn't do yet that I needed it, you know, needed to have it working. But yeah, it was when I had to go back to Final Cut 7, it was like editing with one hand tied behind my back and
wearing a mitten on the other.
Pretty much, yeah. Exactly. And that was when, you know, because had I been on Final Cut 10 on this job, I would have been able to run circles around what I was able to get done.
Right. I think that's the thing that's really frustrating with, and I've spoken with a lot of people who have been saying to me, oh my goodness, I really wish I could use this at my job. I mean, it very much is kind of like 99, 2000, 2001, where people were like using this at the old Final Cut at home or, you know, on their personal projects. And then they're like, I'll even bring in my own computer if you let me. But I'm talking to people that are having those experiences. I got a tweet I think it was this morning from Mark Bach, who I interviewed on the last show. And he was saying that somebody at his job came into his office and said, hey, are you using Final Cut 10? And they had heard him on the podcast. And so he's like, yeah. And it's like, okay, we need to talk. And now, like, there's this whole movement afoot, if you will, where people are, you know, more and more, they're starting to give it, you know, a more serious look. And it's interesting when you have those conversations where people, you know, I call it the aha moment. It's like, oh, I get that. Now, I know that you're doing some work with FCP Works, and you guys are doing how would you describe what FCP Works is?
Well, we're a workflow specialist, and we, you know, specialize in Final Cut 10, like the name of the company.
It's a good name.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, that's the whole thing is, you know, we believe Final Cut 10 works, and we're not ashamed to say it. So
right. So are you seeing people approach you guys who are kind of on that fence, like, okay, we've heard people talking about this, and we have a few last questions to get answered?
You know, when I was at, I spent most of my time at the Red Booth demoing Final Cut 10 workflow.
Okay.
At NAB. And what was interesting is these are all people that came to see the Red Booth.
Right.
And they were just, you know, a lot of the people that came up and I, you know, did the demo and showed them how fast you could actually get editing Red Epic footage in Final Cut 10, it blew their minds.
Yeah.
So most people, if they saw that I was using Final Cut 10, some of them would do the whole, oh, are you using Final Cut 10? And I was like, yeah.
I love having those conversations with people now.
Yeah. They used to be a lot less fun. I'll say that. But this one group of young filmmakers, I said, okay, well, with what you're using now, I'm not going to say names, right. How long would it take you to get 8 hours of Red Epic footage before you could start making selects and, you know, doing rough assemblies and string outs? And I said, oh, probably a few hours.
Yeah.
And I just dragged in the folders and boom, within 15 seconds, and their jaws dropped. Couldn't believe it.
And you were scrubbing through the actual Red footage at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. This is our 3D Red Epic footage right in.
I'm going to ask you a question, and if you want to cut this out because you don't want to answer this, that's totally fine. But you know, and this is just something I just thought of. I've never even thought to verbalize this. You know, I have friends that work at Adobe, and I have seen many an Al Mooney demo. I've seen many a Premiere demo where they speak very candidly about being able to drag in native R3D files into their timeline. What is the difference between the way the Mercury Playback Engine works and Apple's AV Foundation works? What are the pros and cons on those two fronts?
I can't speak to that now because I don't want to. I just don't completely know under the hood.
Okay.
How those things work. However, what I was referring to was in Final Cut 10 that just getting it into the app is drag and drop, and it's quick. Whereas in the case of Creative Cloud as of now,
right?
You know, it has to analyze things, and it takes quite a while. I mean, it's still playing them back natively. I guess that's a feature that they're coming out with that supposedly makes it a little closer, but it's still not as fast as, I mean, 8 hours of footage. Yeah. From the folder into the app, and you're cutting in 15 seconds. That's crazy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's obviously stuff about the cloud I don't totally understand. And I will be the first to say that, you know, I get accused on occasion of coming across like an Apple fanboy and a Final Cut fanboy. And I can understand that accusation. I will ask this to the audience. I wonder if I could get Al Mooney to come and be a guest on this show. I bet he would do that and answer some of those questions. You know, I know that I remember watching him demo the Creative Cloud last year when he demoed the they call it hover scrub, we call it skimming, and right. And it was actually pretty funny the way he did it. It was actually pretty funny the way he did it. He took his mouse and he started hovering over some of the clips in the bins. And he goes, and look, we can hover scrub and you can skim through your stuff. And he pauses and he puts his mouse down for a second. And he looks at the audience and he says, hey, let's face it. Some ideas are worth taking, you know, or I can't remember the exact words, but he said, basically he was saying, oh yeah, we saw that on Apple. And we thought, yeah, it's a good idea. We should do that. Which kind of makes you wonder, are these ideas not patented? But whatever.
That's a whole nother conversation.
The patented features of Final Cut 10?
Yeah, because, I mean, I'd really be interested in knowing more about that. But, you know, it's one of those things where I don't really have to worry about that because as long as you know, the $300 that I spent on the software does those things, then you really shouldn't worry too much about the why.
Somebody said to me a few months ago, he goes, I don't care how it works so long as it keeps working.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that to me, though, I mean, which you asked earlier about why aren't more people using this, it does boggle my mind that it all the excuses are kind of gone now. You know, XML works amazingly.
No, like, I mean, I totally agree.
All the pro stuff is, it works now. I mean, there's really nothing. I can't think of anything that it can't do, with the exception of, gang syncing. Can't do that. That's the only thing.
What is this feature you're calling?
It's so you can match frame things, so you can run to playback in the viewer at the same time, so you can lock them.
Gotcha.
It's for, you know, inserting special effect shots and composites without, you know, time code.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know what? That's an interesting topic. I would love to talk about that someday. I'm going to just go on a little mini rant here. there are a lot of workflow things that we do or have done in the past. And this, and honestly, this has nothing to do with Final Cut 10. This matters if you're using Final Cut 7, please. Premiere, I'm sure it matters. It makes sense with Avid, and it certainly makes sense with Final Cut 10. But I see this, you know, much of the work that we do here is cutting, creating elements in After Effects, whether they be keyable or full frame, bringing them into my bins or my keyword collections, you know, my event, dropping them into my timeline. But invariably there are, invariably there are revisions and iterations that happen. And I see this happen all the time where people, they'll render a new version of something, and because they were kind of casual, I will say, with the endpoint and the outpoint of something coming out of After Effects, and then they have to align it and match frame it back in, and like, oh, am I in sync? And like, I find that kind of stuff frankly infuriating, because it doesn't have to be that way. And there's so often, and again, this has nothing to do with Final Cut 10. This is just standard workflow things. So often, if we would just take a half step back from where we were and re-examine some of our workflow issues, we will find that there are ways that we can work where we won't, we would never have to do those kind of eye match things again.
No,
you know, yeah.
It's sloppy operating.
I think that there is, and I've got into a big discussion with a friend of mine today just about this. There are times when you're under the gun and you just, and I quote, have to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have to get it done, sometimes the way that feels the fastest is the way that you choose. However, if you would take, again, just a half step back, you would realize that just because it feels faster, it isn't. Because anybody who does one revision of something is probably going to have to do two or three. So if you plan ahead and maybe rejigger the way you're arranging things or marking things or rendering things or, you know, whatever, that you could plan ahead so that the second, third, and fourth revision would actually go quicker. You might spend a little bit more time now, but just clean up your workflow. And, you know, actually, I get into this a little bit on one of the tutorials I did on my website about, I call it the poor man's dynamic link between After Effects and Final Cut 10. And showing how in my workflow that if you do things a certain way, you'll never have to relay a piece into a timeline again after you've laid it once.
Right.
You know, and you can, there are ways that you can render more efficiently and kick things out more efficiently and place things more efficiently to the point where making little changes on things take you literally a fraction of the amount of time. Anyway, so
yeah.
I'm just rambling here, but it has a lot to do with this sort of concept of just because you did it this way for the last 10 years doesn't mean it's the best way. What it is it's the way you know how to do it right now.
Yeah, it is pretty, it's challenging for me to get into discussions with people where, you know, they will literally say, well, if it ain't broke, why fix it? And, oh, well, don't you want to go home earlier or get more done and not have to stay late all the time? I mean, that to me should be enough of a motivator, but people get very stubborn when the people come for, you know, they come after the tools that they've been used to using for so long. And I don't know if you heard about Soft Image being EOL'd
No.
today. Yeah. So there's a whole big brouhaha on that, you know.
Help me out here. I don't even know why I would care about Soft Image. What does it do?
It's one of the oldest and, you know, most mature 3D animation apps.
Yeah, and I shy away from 3D.
So whatever – oh, yeah, me too. It's not for me. But it's interesting to consider, though, the difference in changing an editing program and somebody that's used to a particular 3D animation app. It is, like, multiplied by 100 and how difficult it is to adapt to another
right.
one.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, there is that. But, I mean, they have, like, 2 years left of support for right. it. But still, it's just, it is. It's like the same argument that, you know, Final Cut 7 was, quote-unquote, end of EOL'd when Final Cut 10 came out, which just really isn't true because it still runs on the 12-core Mac Pro that we have, yeah. you know, just fine. So, I don't know. It's it is interesting, though, how stubborn people get, though, when...
What do you, Darren, what do you say when you're having those conversations with people where, I mean, I will just say, I look at some people and there's a certain point where I just say, you know what, you're really happy where you are and I'm just going to, you know, let myself out the back door. You know, I mean, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here. How do you approach the conversations when you see somebody who could benefit from Final Cut 10?
You know, it's hard to say without sounding like I'm a cult recruiter or something.
I had somebody say that to I won't say the exact words of what he said to me. But yeah, I got accused of something like that just the other day.
Yeah, it really does come, it has to always come from a place of sincerity that you really do, you know, want to help somebody, you know, and if they're not asking for the help or they're not even curious, it's really, you know, not going to do a whole lot of good. But there are people that are, you know, the ones that are furthest away from the, you know, being open-minded but still have a little bit of open-mindedness are the ones that just wonder why in the hell do I even like it at all, you know?
Right. Oh, they're like they're asking you? They're asking
yeah,
Darren?
Why? Yeah, why, you know, it's terrible. Why would you even, you know, like if they're at least that curious, sometimes I can still at least, you know, have them give it a shot.
Right.
But what it comes down to for me is it really is. It's painful for me to watch people waste their time, you know, doing things the way they, you know, feel like they have to do it that way, you know, because that's just what they're used to. And they don't want to think that maybe, you know, maybe the people that can make Mac Pros like also might be able to make an editing software again and knock it out of the park, you know?
Okay. So if you're having a discussion with somebody who is working in a bigger facility, who is not using Final Cut 10, mm-hmm. and that person comes to you and he says, dude, how do I explain it to my boss? You know, what are the things that I need to show my boss so they'll come around? What kind of advice do you give people?
Well, it really comes down to if you're training in somebody that hasn't edited before, that's a big cost savings, that it's a lot easier to train somebody in this than anything else.
Okay. That also can be seen as a bad thing. We all know the people that are worried about losing their jobs. Unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, that's a whole nother argument, which is, you know, it really is like the playing field is now finally leveled to the point where, you know, if you wanted to make a film in the 90s, you better have an editor and knew how to use a Chem, you know, an 8-plate flatbed editor.
Right.
And, but they had to know how to tell a story. And they knew how, you know, they had to know those things. But there was also the big, steep, you know, the big barrier was the fact you had to own all this equipment.
Right.
And know how to use it, keep it maintained. So then Avids became all of a sudden $50,000 instead of $150,000. And then all these people in Minneapolis ran out and bought an Avid. And were like, I'm an editor now. It's like, no, you know how to work an Avid. That doesn't make you an editor. So,
well, actually, it could be as bad as saying, no, you know how to buy an Avid.
That's true. It doesn't make you an editor. Yeah. And some of them got good. And other ones didn't, but it didn't matter because they just had people over their shoulders telling them exactly where they wanted them to cut.
Right.
But now, I mean, anybody can edit. It's can they do it well? And that's, to me, that's – if you're just looking at the bottom line as a business, you'd probably want people to be able to get their job done better in the same amount of time, because deadlines, you know, they just keep getting quicker.
It seems like.
And there is that push pull because you used to have to like wait a day for all the renders to happen.
Right.
10 years ago, that was just a thing. Now, any client that's waiting for a render is a client you're probably not going to have anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, we used to do 24-hour renders all the time.
Yeah, and it
especially like the early days of H.264 when the stability wasn't there.
Yeah, and you get glitches and you have to redo it. And I mean,
nightmare.
There's all kinds of things that people just take for granted now. And
the whole time we're looking at ourselves going, what are we doing? This doesn't work. This stuff does not work.
Well, the only thing I miss about rendering is it was the only time I could ever justify taking a lunch break. You know? That's the only thing I miss about it.
Yeah, no, I actually there's a rather famous story, and I've never actually seen this, but I will tell the story nonetheless. At a well-known post facility in San Francisco, there was an editor who created an MOV that filled his desktop with a random timeline and a 10-minute render bar on his Avid. And periodically he would open up that file, play it full screen, and turn to the producer and go, yeah, it looks like this is going to be about 10 minutes. I'll be right back. And he would go out and have a smoke, you know, and it was his trick. Not that he probably didn't have plenty of things that he actually did need to render, but yeah, no, I think that there is a promise. We have been promised something when it came to computers, and we have been lied to, I say, for the last 25 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that promise was these magic computer boxes will make our life better. And if we look at how we work today versus how we used to work 20 years ago, and granted, there's a lot of kids that are young enough that, you know, they didn't have a job 20 years ago. I understand. But I'm the old guy in the room, so I'm telling you.
Those are the easiest to convince to use Final Cut 10, though, by the way. So
really? Older people?
Younger. People that didn't have a job 20 years ago.
Okay, yeah. Because, yeah, okay, I got you. So, but the promise was that these computers are going to make our life better. And yet, we work longer. We are bothered by our bosses more. You know, this perpetual connection thing means that people are getting, you know, called into the office, or not even called into the office, but just contacted in the middle of, you know, Saturday afternoon with your kids. Oh, you need to, you know, look at these three emails and deal with them. But mm-hmm. the promise that these computer boxes were going to make our life easier has by and large been a lie. And if we look at what nonlinear editing was going to do for us, if we go back 25 years in the beginning of the Avid, it was like, well, this will be great. We'll be able to make decisions quicker. We'll be able to, you know, it's not the end of the world if you want to add a shot in the first 5 minutes and ripple everything down. And I think everybody thought that, oh, you know, we're going to actually, you know, work will be easier. And it hasn't been. And it, the reason it hasn't been is that we've been given so many options. And quite often, I hate to say it, working for people that don't know how to make a decision. So they want to, well, can you just, why don't you just make me all four versions? Because I need, I'm a visual person. I need to see it.
Nonlinear editing on a computer is, it didn't help people make decisions faster. It just allows, it just facilitates making lots of bad decisions quicker.
That's Darren, that is the best way of putting it. You much more eloquently said exactly what I was trying to say. Yes, it facilitates you making bad decisions quicker. And then, you know, like a million monkeys on a million typewriters, one of them eventually is going to type Shakespeare. You know, eventually one of a, you know, one of these bad decisions will actually yield, or after taking all these bad decisions will actually yield a somewhat acceptable return. But I think, and this is my own theory, that Final Cut 10 is kind to me. I'm just going to say to me, it's getting to the point where I realize I really am working faster. There are, and I'm just literally scratching the surface of finding ways that I can use the software more intelligently. And I'm actually working, I'll say this, I'm working so much less I can produce 3 hours of podcasts a week. So there.
Well, that's good. I mean, that to me right there is, I mean, to answer the earlier question, I had some time to actually think of it. It really is like that should be the goal, because, you know, you can always get money again. You can never get time back. That's ultimately, you know, that's to me, to saving time is always more valuable to me than trying to save money. And I don't know, that's the real interesting thing though with the whole debate, is that people don't really want to see, you know, if they see themselves as the man behind the curtain in Wizard of Oz, and then everybody can actually do the technical, like, button pushing, then everybody gets scared.
Right.
That now everybody can do their job, but it's just not true.
Yeah.
It's just the people that are good at what they do can just do it quicker and not have to think about all the technical stuff. I mean,
regardless of how easy the tool is to operate, a good editor will still be faster than a bad editor.
Yeah, I mean,
or somebody who should not be editing at all.
Yeah, one of the guys I used to work for when I was, you know, an actual, like, assistant to, like, on film editing. And the Avid started becoming affordable, and then Final Cut came out, and, you know, the one guy would say, it's like, I can cut faster on a Chem than most people can cut on an Avid, because you have to think about what you're going to do. And he was right up to a point, and then he realized, now I'm going to switch to computers eventually, but... Because, you know, his argument was, well, you know, it's all in your head and you have to creatively, you know, think things through. But what you were saying earlier about how, you know, you could do five different versions, but why not just spend the time really knowing the footage and do it right in the first place by spending more time actually trying to pre-imagine it.
Right.
I guess. But yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with, like, digital now replacing film, which there, did you ever see that film Side by Side?
No. What is that?
It's a documentary and it's awesome. Is that Tribeca, like, 2 years ago? It's, you can get it on iTunes, but, it's about people, tons of, you know, big, huge filmmakers like Soderbergh and George Lucas. And,
oh, is this the one that Keanu Reeves produced?
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
He does the interviewing. He's actually quite good in it. Right. But it's all about digital versus film.
Right.
And all the digital people, they have the same arguments and praise for it. they're almost like reading off their own internal script. Whereas the film people, it's just this romanticized, you know, fairy dust and magic kind of, you know, just completely irrational, but yet they're right too, you know. And that's, to me, it's what was interesting about the film was, you know, they're talking about things on this level of, well, you know, with digital, they just shoot a lot more bad takes and crap and waste more time. And
right.
Film, you really have to, you know, it's more precious to you, so you're going to take it more seriously, and that's why it's always going to be better. And, you know, my opinion about that is just, well, just get better at shooting with, you know, your Red camera or your Blackmagic or Alexa or DSLR or whatever you're shooting with. Just apply the same discipline and craft that you would if you were shooting film. You
know? Right. I mean, but I think there's certainly something to that. I mean, if you go back 20 years and you looked at the guy who was sitting in the big edit suite, the reason he was sitting there is he had proven himself to be worthy of the responsibility of driving that room and that equipment.
Oh, yeah, because that room was very expensive.
That room was very expensive. And you didn't just let some kid say, hey, I got some ideas. Let me at that thing. You know, it just didn't happen. And I think that there is an upside to having a kid sit down at his laptop and slamming together some different shots that he shot on his iPhone. There's a good side to that. I think there is a bad side, but I believe that the good outweighs the bad. You know, I'm glad that more people are making, you know, digital shorts or whatever you want to call them. I mean, let me find a guy's name here because I spent about a half hour today. He made a piece called, this was fairly well viewed a while back. It was called At Day Afternoon. Okay? And it's made by a guy named, let me get his name for you, Patrick Bolvin, B-O-L-V-I-N.
Uh-huh.
And At Day Afternoon is a guy who's shooting with, I think he shot it with a DSLR, and he takes an old At toy that was his when he was a kid. This is 3 years old now. It's been viewed, well, at least 3 million times. And he does a bunch of stop motion stuff. And actually, what's more interesting than the piece is to watch his making of and how simple some of the effects that he did were. But I don't know what Patrick Bolvin's background is. He might be, you know, a world-class stop-motion artist that works on major Hollywood films, and he does these things for fun. But he has done some great pieces, and if you go to Patrick Bolvin on the YouTube channel thing, you can see he does Iron Man versus Bruce Lee, which was quite good.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those. I've seen some of those.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know who he is.
Yeah, he did that one. He also did Dragon Baby, which is this little kid doing kung fu against this walking dragon stuffed toy. He did a thing called Iron Baby, which is a takeoff of Iron Man with his kid.
Yeah, yeah, that was great.
And so I look at stuff like that, and this is a guy with, oh, well over 100 million views collectively on his YouTube channel. Actually, wait, YouTube will tell me that somewhere. Okay, he has nearly 2 million views in 4 years. Here's a guy that's had, I mean, you know, he's got some clout out there. He's got a lot of people looking at his work. And I don't know. And again, Patrick, if you are listening to this, I don't know if you will. But if you, please don't, I'm just speaking out of ignorance as I always do. But if you take a guy like Patrick Bolvin and, you know, maybe he's not a big Hollywood player, stop motion guy. And I almost hope that he isn't, because he's absolutely killing it out there with the work that he's doing, and he's doing it outside of the system. And I love that stuff like that happens. That's why I'm a huge fan of YouTube. I have been for a long time, because it allows people like Patrick Bolvin to get his work in front of my eyeballs. And I love that. I just love it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the like what a film festival was is now YouTube in
right.
some ways, except for the fact that, you know, about 15, 14 years ago, I worked on a bunch of films that were submitted to Sundance. One, I guess, actually got in. But there at the time, there were like 300 submissions.
Right.
In the feature, you know, for features.
Okay.
And now there's like 3,000 or 4,000, I guess.
Wow.
That's how many they get every year. But, you know, it is. It is the content explosion, but it's like when word processors, you know, became essentially free with purchase of any computer, you know, there's been no more, you know, great novels written as a result. It's the same thing with film. It's just, you know, the cream does rise to the top. But there's a lot more books, you know, that were being written in the 80s, but there just weren't, you know, there wasn't like an influx of better ones necessarily.
Right.
So I kind of, you know, it's kind of the same thing. Just everybody can make a movie. Do they do it well? Not usually.
Right.
But it's awesome when they do, you know, and the fact that it has democratized it to the point where, you know, anybody can show something to anybody in the world.
Right.
I mean, that 2006 changed everything.
The birth of YouTube?
There was no distribution. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's that to me, it's like it. That is the day it really changed. Because, you know, I owned an HVX 200 when it came out.
Uh-huh.
As soon as that, you know, when I saw that camera specs at NAB that year, I'm like, I'm buying that camera. And it really did change, you know, like the level of quality I could deliver on my personal work, because I was able to shoot a lot more without it costing me money.
Right.
I didn't have to buy film, because, like, my first music videos, I would do a music video shot on film for $1,000. That was how I turned and burned those.
Right.
Because it would be two rolls of 16, and I would have to, you know, map out all the shots that I did. I mean, I almost, like, I didn't edit in camera, but I definitely knew how long I would ever use a shot for.
Right.
And that's all I would shoot. I would shoot a couple takes of a 4-second long shot, and that would be it. No slates, nothing, because that wasted film.
Exactly.
And now I don't have to worry about those things, but there's still like the habits that are kind of in my brain now.
Yep.
To sum this up though, it is we're in a very interesting time now, which is looking at the future. There's anybody can do this. It's just going to be a normal thing. Whereas if you made films when I was a kid, that was like bizarro world, you know? Yeah. And now anybody can do it. And so now it's not as special, but I think that could ultimately be a good thing.
Let me ask you one last question, Darren. If you had the ability to sneak into the infinite loop or whatever building the programmers are working on, Final Cut 10 up in Cupertino, and you could get them to make you one feature, what would you ask them to do?
You know, that's a tough question, because I was on FCP.co, and I'm forgetting the gentleman's name that always starts the you know, Final Cut 10, whatever the next incremental release, you know, pre-release discussion.
Would it be Richard Taylor?
Is it Disproportionate Pictures?
Oh, no, I don't know this one.
Yeah, he's, I forget his name, but his actual name, but he always starts that. And for the first time I actually answered, you know, after like 10.1, I was pretty happy with kind of where it's at right now. I don't necessarily know that I I can't think of, like, I literally can't think of anything I would need it to do at this point.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's really weird. There has always been things like, you know, I really wanted to be able to have a centralized, project file, and now we have libraries.
Right.
That was my big last gripe.
Right.
And they kind of fixed it. So I don't know. What would you want to have? If you've answered this on other shows,
You know what? Don't put me on the spot like that, because I'm the guy who asks the questions. Damn it! No,
I know.
I actually have not really formulated my thought on that, and I will do that by the next episode. I know that there's a few little bugs that I'm dealing with. There's the audio EQ bug, which is bugging me like crazy. Oh, yeah.
There are bugs that I would definitely want.
And I know that that stuff is happening. It has to. And I will say this once again, because I have been told by people inside Apple that they would love it if we get the message out to tell people, please use the feature request thing that's under the Final Cut Pro menu.
Oh, I remember. Okay, I remember.
Oh, you have a feature?
I have one thing, yes.
Yeah, so at any rate, use that thing, because there are people whose only job is to read that and to sort and collate and report on those feature requests. So anyway,
what I've read. The feature requests that I would wish that they would give has actually been semi-addressed by somebody, some genius that actually made an app. But it would be to actually be able to relink files if everything, wasn't exactly like, it was supposed to be.
You're bringing up something. I know exactly. Come to think of it, why didn't I think of this? I am actually keeping a list in case I ever do run into a guy and he goes, "Hey, what feature do you want?" I actually now have a list in my phone, and the number one thing on my list, I had forgot I made that list, is what I would call the difference between an absolute and a relative path structure.
Yep.
Okay. And does that make sense if I say it that way to you?
Not quite.
Okay, so this harkens to web development. When you give somebody a web address, I will tell you that the image that I want you to look at is at, chrisfenwick.com/gfx/awesomepicture.jpg. Okay?
Right.
That is a absolute address. It starts with the www, okay? A relative address would be, if you're already on chrisfenwick.com, a relative address says /graphics/awesomepicture.jpg. Okay, it doesn't need to have the preamble, so to speak, or the entire URL. It just has to keep track of where I am relative, or where that thing is relative to where I am. Okay. And this is used all the time in web development, because when people make a web page with relative links, it makes it easier to make that website transportable. I can move it from here to there or here to there, whatever. But if you use absolute links, when you move a website from one box to another, you have to change everything, and it's ridiculous. Okay, so when you move a project from drive A to drive B, and you go to open it, you have to relink everything. But the library file is relative. It's in a assuming you're using some sort of a job folder, which I do, that library file, it has the same relative path to all of the media files that are linked to it. So if Final Cut 10's database had relative paths as opposed to absolute paths that said, when you're looking for this MOV, look on drive, Happy Feet, or, look on Nemo /all my Final Cut Pro projects/this is my best Final Cut Pro project/library/media/whatever. Okay, but by using relative links, all of that relinking when you move a job from drive A to drive B would be a thing of the past.
Yeah, I mean, that would be useful. what I'm kind of talking about is, like, for example, on all the documentaries, one of them has been edited in every version of Final Cut since, like, 10.0.1.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. And so it's been upgraded
many times
through all of them.
Yep.
And it has wreaked havoc on this project file, and I'm finally getting rid of all the gremlins.
Interesting.
Because the way that Final Cut originally started handling, you know, the file structure within the app was completely different by 10.0.3. Interesting. And then changed again in 10.0.6. And now, obviously, with 10.1, completely different again. And what that did is certain files, because this is, you know, a documentary and there's footage from sources that before you should never put on a timeline, but Final Cut 10 allows you to do it. It's like Jurassic Park, you know, just because you can do it doesn't mean you necessarily should. But yeah, people did it.
Yeah.
And those particular files, when they get changed from one version of Final Cut 10 to the next, the timing changes, and then they go offline, and there is no good way to actually relink them.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So it's the feature that I would want is take the training wheels off and just let it deal with it, you know? Let it relink to it, even though it says, no, it's like, you know, this is different, and this has audio, and that one didn't. It's like,
yes,
just do what I ask. You know, that's the big one.
I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, if they just, like, you know, you have a little, you know, like the break glass in case of emergency. Like, if they just have a setting that allows you to, you know, do it anyway.
Yeah, like an expert mode. Like, if I hold down the control key, that means give me more control.
Yeah, just something like that. But that's the big gripe, and that's really the one thing that does affect what I do.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
But
very cool. Darren, I'm going to let you go. I know you're not feeling well, and I hope you feel better sometime in the future. When you're feeling better, let's do this again. And
when I find who gave me this cold at NAB, which I still have, it's one of the 800 or 900 people. If you're listening and you gave me a cold, you have to apologize.
Send him a note on Twitter. Hey, Darren, if people are trying to find you online, what's the best way to hook up with you?
Well, I mean, Darren at fcpworks.com is my email address.
Okay.
Asking, you know, having people ask me.
Are you on Twitter or Facebook or anything like that?
I am on Twitter, and I, because I direct comedy shorts and things like that, I'm really reluctant to actually. I might have to make up a new Twitter, like, on top of the one that I have, because I'm like, I don't really want people, like, work-related reading my actual Twitter necessarily, so.
Now, that's very interesting, because to me, Twitter is all about work, and Facebook is just a cobweb site that I only retain so other people named Chris Fenwick can't get facebook.com/Chris Fenwick.
But it is, I mean, but the thing is, it is about work to me. It's just a different side of it. Like,
yeah,
the things I've done for Funny or Die, I wouldn't recommend anybody watch them at work. So that was still work, though. It's
right.
Just that work is not safe for other work. Let's just leave it there.
Let me ask you this, and I don't, you know, a bad interviewer, I did not realize, I knew you mentioned Funny or Die. What are some of the big hit things on Funny or Die you worked on that I might know?
Well, I've done a few shorts with a guy named John Daly. He's on Kroll Show on Comedy Central.
Uh-huh.
We made up a character called Bill Cosby Bukowski.
Okay.
Which is, you know, Bill Cosby and Charles Bukowski got Frankenstein together in a lightning storm, and, you know, he was formed.
Gotcha.
That did pretty, like, a couple of those did pretty well. But I've helped out on a lot of other things, and those are the ones that I directed that actually put on the front page. So
cool.
That was very nice of them.
Darren, we will talk again. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat tonight.
Thank you. It was fun.
Take care.
So that was Darren. I hope you enjoyed our chat. Darren had told me after we stopped the recording, he said, I'm kind of on a little bit of medication. I hope it came across okay. Anyway, he was amazing to talk to at NAB, and I really wanted to get him on the show. So if you think of it and you have a little extra time, I want to ask a favor of you. One, support Premium Beats. They've been great to me, and I want all of us to support them. I love their music, and we're going to talk about them a lot in the future. Also, go to the iTunes where you subscribe to the podcast. There's a little place where you can leave comments and stars, and those comments really help the show get noticed, and it actually makes it rank higher when you comment. So that's cool. And then that way more people get to find out about the show and all that. So, and you know, it's been amazing. I really appreciate all of the support and love that we get there. So thanks for listening. We will be back. What day is today? I don't even know. It's Thursday night, Friday. So this is the Friday show. We're going to have another show for you Monday. Take care. And we will be back then. Until then, this is Final Cut Grill. Later.